pallbearers were carrying the casket down this little path. There was a bend in the path, and there was a rock in that bend, and one of the pallbearers stumbled over the rock. They all brought the casket, and it opened, and the body rolled out, and the woman revived. In fact, she lived with her husband for 3 more years, and then she passed away. So they're having another service. Those exact same pallbearers coming down the exact same path to that one bend, and the husband yells out, "Watch out for that rock!" For us as Christians, there is nothing more exciting than for what we are gathered here for today. The resurrection of Jesus Christ is the chief claim of our faith. Paul writes in Romans chapter 1, "Who through the Spirit of holiness was declared with power to be the Son of God by his resurrection from the dead, Jesus Christ our Lord." Christianity rises or falls on this claim that when they crucified this young rabbi from Nazareth, they were putting a transient in the tomb. This one claim makes or breaks all other claims. Even secular students of Christianity realize the significance of the doctrine of the resurrection. Several years back, in Newsweek magazine, there was an article on the unique doctrine of the resurrection in the Christian faith. And the writer in that article said this: "By any measure, the resurrection of Jesus is the most radical of Christian doctrines. His teaching, his compassion for others, even his martyr's death, all find parallels in stories in other religious traditions. But of no other historical figure has the claim been made more persistently that God raised Jesus from the dead. The difference between Christianity and other world religions is you can't go to the tomb of the founder of Christianity where his body is still in the ground and worship there. You can go to a tomb. It's just empty." Popular Christian minister in the United States said that he was touring the Holy Land, and a Jewish guy took them out one morning to the tomb that is supposed to be the place where Jesus' body was laid. And they got there, and the guide said this: "This is the tomb where Jesus isn't." And that is what is unique about Christianity. In 2001, when Tiger Woods won the Masters for the second time, he was asked what he would ever say to Bobby Jones. Bobby Jones was the great golfer who was the Tiger Woods of his own generation. He actually designed the Augusta National Golf Course. Bobby Jones died way before Tiger Woods was even born. Tiger was asked, "So what would you say if Bobby Jones walked in here today, right now?" Tiger Woods said, "I'd ask how he came back. If I go out, all I want to know is, how do I get back?" There is out there a group that would claim that they're Christians, but they say it's not really important whether or not Jesus raised from the dead. What is important is that you believe in the Easter principle, that bad things might get better. Nope. Christianity without the resurrection of Jesus isn't just missing the last chapter. It's missing the entire story. The Apostle Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 15, "And if Christ has not been raised, then all our preaching is useless and your faith is useless." You see, if the tomb is not empty, and Christianity is, it's really that simple. To be Christian is fundamentally to to declare that Jesus is risen from the dead. That's why the critics of Christianity from the very beginning have tried to attack this particular claim. They have tried to discredit the story of the resurrection. Now on this, we all can agree. Whether you're a Christian, whether you're an atheist, whether you are a friend or a foe of Christianity, we can all agree on three things. We can all agree that Jesus of Nazareth was crucified by the Romans. We all agree that the Jews took great effort and precaution to seal the tomb they put his body in. And we can all agree that his body is missing. So what happened? I believe to be a Christian is to live by faith, not by sight. I don't believe that faith means I've got to turn my brain off. I don't believe faith means I've got to stop using my head and only walk with my heart. What we're going to do is we're going to examine the evidence and we're going to ask ourselves some questions. What is the best and most credible explanation for what happened to the body of Jesus? So I want to ask three questions this morning. First, what best explains the gospel records? So we have these four ancient accounts, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they were very early on the scene, and they all say Jesus has risen from the dead. Now, critics are going to contend that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were just fabrications designed to support the myth of this resurrection of Jesus. Well, if so, let's ask some difficult questions then. Why do they include no eyewitness description of the resurrection? Do you realize that? That we have no eyewitness description of the resurrection? If I was going to write a lie about the resurrection of Jesus, I put somebody in the story that actually saw him rise out of the tomb. And why did they portray the disciples as dull, even hostile toward the idea of a resurrection? I'd write the story so that they were like anticipating it. They were expecting it to occur. And why did they not paint the enemies of Christ monolithically? Instead, you've got the Sanhedrin, and you've got this character named Joseph of Arimathea, who is very empathetic to Jesus, who is named so that you can go and verify by his descendants what indeed actually occurred. And why on earth did they let women be the first witnesses of the resurrected Christ? Because back in that day, the testimony of a woman was worthless. It wasn't even allowed in a court of law. So if you're going to start a legend, you better have some guys seeing Jesus first. Why did they write the story the way that they did? Because if you're going to write a legend, then they made some very dumb choices. Or did they write it the way that they wrote it, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? Because that is exactly how it happened. And remember this, they set the entire drama in Jerusalem, not in Alexandria, in Africa, not out in France somewhere. They did it in Jerusalem, the hardest place to spread lies, because too many people were actually there when it happened. They were still around to go and check out the facts with the people who were saying what has occurred. So the question would be, what best explains the gospel records? Another question to ask is, what best explains the missing body? That is a problem for the skeptic. Some have tried to say, well, maybe the body is not missing. Maybe the women just went to the wrong tomb. Like Joseph of Arimathea didn't know where his own tomb was. Or maybe they all were hallucinating. Which, if you do any work in the field of psychology, you know how preposterous such a notion is. People who are not expecting something to happen don't hallucinate about it happening. Hallucinations don't last for 40 days and then just stop. 500 people don't have the same hallucination at the same time. If I walked up to you and I said to you, "Hey, what'd you think of my dream last night?" You would think I was crazy. The biggest problem with all of those theories is simply this. If the women went to the wrong tomb, or if it was just a hallucination, then why did not the Jewish leaders, go to the right tomb, roll away the stone, grab the body and say, "Here's your dead Messiah." And then Christianity just dies. No ancient Christian or secular scholar would argue that the body is in the tomb. They all admit from the very beginning that the body of Jesus is missing. So what happened to it? Well, there have been three basic theories put forth by the skeptics. One is this: the Jews and the enemies of Christ stole his body. The question is, why? Why would they do that? What would be their motive? Why would they help start the very thing that they wanted to stop? If they had the body, they could have produced it and ended it. Remember again, Christianity is in the city where it would have been hardest to start if the facts aren't right. And all the critics did was threaten the disciples to stop preaching about Jesus being risen from the dead, because that is all they could do. The enemies of Jesus did not take his body. But here is the most popular theory, and that is the Christians stole his body. They stole the body, and then they started preaching the lie that Jesus was raised from the dead. Now, that has been around literally from the very beginning. You go back into Matthew chapter 28, beginning in verse 11, and the gospel writer Matthew records these words: "While the women were on their way, some guards went into the city and reported to the chief priests everything that had happened. When the chief priests had met with the elders and devised a plan, they gave the soldiers a large sum of money, telling them, 'You are to say, his disciples came during the night and stole him away while we were asleep. If this report gets to the governor, we'll satisfy him and keep you out of trouble.' So the soldiers, they took the money and they did as they were instructed. And this story has been widely circulated among the Jews to this very day." But the story's got problems. First, guards in those days had a great incentive to not fall asleep. Their incentive was called death. If you fell asleep, you died. Why would they have to be bribed if this is what happened was really the case? What court of law accepts the testimony of somebody that had fallen asleep? When have you ever been to a trial and the lawyer said, "Okay, now tell me what happened while you were asleep"? How did the disciples actually sneak past these guards, roll back this gigantic stone, carry out the body of Jesus, and not one of them wakes up? But here's the biggest problem. What is to gain with the disciples doing this? What do they get out of stealing the body of Jesus? Do they get some kind of notoriety? Do they get fame? Do they become rich? They got kicked out of synagogues. They lost their jobs. They got run out of their homes, their towns. Their properties were confiscated. They got thrown into prison. They were tortured. They were killed. You have to understand something very important. People will die for a lie if they think it's true, but people will not die for a lie when they know it's not true. Charles Colson was a very important figure in the Richard Nixon administration. He was involved in the Watergate scandal. He went to prison. While he was in prison, he found Jesus. He became a very powerful evangelist. And he was asked this question: "What lesson did you learn from the Watergate story?" He said, well, you know what? I learned to believe in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And this is how he would explain it. There were only 10 of us, he said, that knew the truth. Myself, Ehrlichman, Haldeman, John Mitchell, and just a handful of other people. And we were absolutely devoted to Richard Nixon. We had just helped him win a landslide election. The ugly Asian war was finally over. We were on this crest of a wave, riding this popularity. And you can't imagine the kind of power that we had. We managed billions of dollars. We could pick up a phone, and armies and of generals, our generals and armies would just jump to attention. We had private planes that would fly us anywhere in the world that we wanted to go. We had red jacket service to take care of our every need. I could call, he said, the National Gallery and have priceless pieces of art hanging over my desk if I would so inquire. He said, and yet, when a little bit of pressure got put on us to cover up this lie, just 10 people, we couldn't do it. There was no threat of execution. There was maybe the threat of embarrassment. Maybe a little bit of jail time. But every single one of us cracked. Because the human instinct for self-preservation is that strong. People will die for a lie if they really believe it's true. But people will not die for a lie when they know it's not true. Liars make terrible martyrs. And the early Christians did not go all over the world and get tortured and crucified and burned with oil and have their skin ripped off for something that they knew was a lie. And not one of them cracked. The disciples did not steal the body of Jesus. Another theory arrived about the 18th century. It's called the swoon theory, and it argues that Jesus had a resuscitation, not a resurrection. In other words, he didn't really die when he was on the cross. He kind of went into a coma, and he came to while he was put away in the tomb. The disciples actually thought that this was a resurrection, but it wasn't. So let me get this straight. I'm supposed to believe that the Romans flogged him. And if you've seen the movie The Passion of the Christ, you get some semblance of what that actually means. They crucified him. They put a spear in his side to prove that he was dead, took him down, wrapped him up in grave clothes, put him in a damp tomb with no food or water for 3 days. Then somehow he comes to, he takes these clothes off, he has the ability to roll this giant stone away from the inside, and he fights the guards, beats them up, walks miles from where he's at, presents himself to his disciples, and says, I was raised from the dead. You want a body like mine, don't you? I think it takes more faith to believe that than it does the resurrection. Plus, you just have to forget the fact that Romans were experts in how to kill people. Here's my point. 20 centuries later, and the skeptics have failed to produce a credible explanation for the missing body of Jesus. All they do is shake their finger and they say, well, he couldn't be raised from the dead because that just doesn't happen. It's never happened before, and it's never happened since, so it couldn't have happened to Jesus. Third question to ask is this: what best explains historical Christianity? How do you explain Christianity actually becoming a world religion? You go back to AD 35, and if you're a betting man, where would you put your money? Which of these two are going to survive? This little Jewish cult called Christianity or the Roman Empire? I mean, who's going to make it? How do you explain this little teeny Christian cult that gets catapulted all across the earth by men and women ready to die for what they believe. Again, remember, where is it starting? In Jerusalem, the hardest place for it to start if it's not true. If it is there that the very first sermon is preached in Acts chapter 2. Mariah read the scripture right at the beginning of the service. She did a great job. And it says this in the middle of a sermon. Peter said, "But God raised him from the dead, freeing him from the agony of death, because it was impossible for death to keep its hold on him." One chapter later, Peter is preaching again, and he says, "You killed the author of life, but God raised him from the dead." We are witnesses of this. Paul preached the exact same way. You go to Acts chapter 13, and Paul is preaching, "Brothers, children of Abraham, and you God-fearing Gentiles, it is to us that this message of salvation has been sent. The people of Jerusalem and their rulers did not recognize Jesus. Yet in condemning him, they fulfilled the words of the prophets that are read every Sabbath. Though they found no proper ground for a death sentence, they asked Pilate to have him executed. And when they had carried out all that was written about him, they took him down from the tree and laid him in a tomb. But God raised him from the dead. And for many days he was seen by those who had traveled with him from Galilee to Jerusalem. They are now his witnesses to our people." And you have to understand, they named the witnesses in some of their writing. They said, "Here, he saw him, she saw him, they saw him." They were challenging the readers to go back and check this out. "We're telling you the truth. They're still here. Go ask them." Why did they start meeting on the first day of the week? Why is that special? Why did they put such an emphasis on this ordinance called baptism, where you bury somebody under water and then you raise them up and declare they're now capable of living a brand new life? What about critics and skeptics like James, the very brother of Jesus, and the rabbi Saul, who was persecuting Christians? What happened to those guys that made them into defenders of Christianity, willing to die for it? Why did they suffer persecution and murder gladly? Because they had witnessed something. They witnessed a miracle. You see, at some point, it ceases to be an historical issue, and it becomes a philosophical issue about whether or not miracles are possible. People say, "It didn't happen because it can't happen." Well, guess what? I agree. I contend there is no way naturally that Jesus was raised from the dead. But we are declaring the resurrection of Jesus was not a natural event. It was a supernatural event. And it is the best explanation based on the evidence. It simply requires the hypothesis that God does indeed exist. And that means taking a leap of faith. But it is not a leap devoid of reason. You don't have to turn your head off to become a Christian. The evidence is compelling. If you've never read the book, The Case for Christ by Lee Strobel, I'd encourage you to do so. But in that book, he gives, for example, the testimony of Sir Lionel Luckhoo, who was called by Guinness Book of World Records the world's greatest attorney. 245 straight murder acquittals. And in his own spiritual journey, this man, who was twice knighted by Queen Elizabeth, studied the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus, and he wrote down these words: "I say unequivocally that the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus Christ is so overwhelming, it compels acceptance by proof, which leaves absolutely no room for doubt. In the exact same book, he tells about being a moderator at a debate between William Lane Craig, a very popular Christian author and apologist, and a speaker chosen by the American Atheist Society. This debate occurred back in 1993. There were 8,000 people in the room at this debate, and over 100 radio stations carried this debate live. He said it was so amazing to stand on that stage and literally see the faces of people in the audience change as William Lane Craig laid out for them the evidence of the resurrected Jesus Christ. 82% of the people that night that were in attendance said that they were convinced the Christian case was the most convincing. And the amazing thing, that particular night, 47 people who walked into that room as an atheist left as a fully devoted believer in Jesus. And maybe you've heard the amazing story of Dr. Anthony Flew. For many years, perhaps most of my particular life, this brilliant English scholar has been the atheist's greatest champion. He held debates literally all over the world. Several years back, he shocked the world, and he wrote a book entitled, An Atheist Turns to Theism. And in that book, he argued, I had to go where the evidence led me. And the evidence leads me to believe there must be some grand designer or creator to explain our particular existence. Now, he's not claiming that he's a Christian. He's simply arguing that the evidence is too overwhelming to believe anymore, that all we are is just an accident. Now, over the years, he became friends with a Christian by the name of Dr. Gary Habermas, who preaches at Liberty University. They had several debates on the possibility of a resurrection. And Dr. Habermas, who became a good friend of Dr. Flew, said, now that you believe in a greater power, can you concede that the resurrection is at least a possibility? And Dr. Flew said, I have to concede that. And he asked Dr. Flew, then what do you say about the resurrection of Jesus Christ? And the man, until a few years ago, was the atheist's greatest champion, said, the evidence for the resurrection is better than proclaimed miracles in any other world religion. Is the real problem in accepting the resurrection of Christ a lack of evidence? Or is it a lack of will to bow to the implications of the evidence? The evidence for Jesus is so strong that nobody would question it except for two things. First, it's a very unusual event. And second, if you believe it really happened, you actually have to change the way that you live. And that's the real problem. Most intellectual doubt is really a moral issue. I don't want to surrender to anybody, but here's what you have to realize. If the tomb had to surrender to Jesus, so do you, my friend. The problem is not our head. The problem is our heart. I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. He is the only way to God. He is the only way to be right with God. I believe by His grace I am saved, and by His blood I am cleansed. I believe every single page of the Bible leads us to Jesus. And it's time that some of you get off of the fence and decide once and for all that Jesus Christ really, truly is Lord over everything, including me. When Mount Vesuvius erupted, the city of Pompeii was instantly covered in molten ash and lava. Lots of artifacts have been recovered from that site. And one of the most interesting was a gold and silver statue of the god Mercury that was in the hand of a woman who was buried in feet of molten ash. The irony is that the god Mercury is the god of safe passage. It's not that she didn't have faith. She had placed her faith in a god that she thought would protect her. But you see, she had faith in a god that was not worthy of her faith. And today, I stand here to declare to you that Jesus Christ is worthy of your faith. He is worthy of your adoration. He is worthy of being Lord over every single part of your life. And today, you need to decide to worship Him not only with your head, but with all of your heart. And I am betting my life on this side of the grave, and I am trusting my life on the other side of the grave, that Jesus Christ is risen from the dead. And it is time for you to make that decision in your own life. And we're going to sing a song of invitation this morning. And I would encourage you to make that decision public. Would you please rise as we get ready to sing a song of invitation?